Hello, everyone. My name is Jim, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
Hello, family. Welcome to the 8 o'clock Saturday open speaker meeting of the Central Orlando Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. And to introduce the speaker, I can tell you that I did meet him about 9 years ago. I became a friend of his about 5 years ago, and I became a real good friend about 2.5 years ago. He is my spiritual advisor, my guide through the book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he's a gentleman that does more for recovering alcoholics every day than the other man I know through a website he hosts. So please welcome Wee Willie.
Yeah.
Make sure this thing is off.
It's on.
I'll fix it. My name is Willie. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Willie.
I'm a very grateful, recovered alcoholic. I thank Jim for the introduction. You know, I mean, he's Irish, and it's obvious that he has kissed the Blarney Stone at one time or the other. I also found out that half the lies he tells aren't true. I'd like to welcome anyone. Is this on? I'd like to welcome anyone who's new or anyone who's coming back. And this talk is for you. Let me be your guinea pig. Okay? I've got the greatest love and admiration, respect for Alcoholics Anonymous. My whole life today centers around AA, and it has done since I got sober. And, you know, there's so much to say in so little time. I'm going to have to learn to speak in shorthand. Where I come from, in the west of Scotland, I've been accused of being a big book thumper. And that's an accusation that I plead guilty to with no apologies. So tonight, you're not going to get a drunkologue, I can assure you. But in fairness, you know, I will give you just a brief thumbnail sketch of what I used to be like and what happened and what it's like now. I would love to stand here tonight and say that since the first time I came to AA, I've never had a drink. And that everything in my life has been wonderful. But that's not true. What is true is that the worst part of my life, the worst part, started after I came to AA. And it was bad enough when I got here the first time, I can assure you. I was born into an alcoholic home. Both my parents were alcoholic. I had six sisters. I was the only boy. You know, and I've often said that I was three times as unfortunate in life as Cinderella. She only had two ugly sisters. And I'm glad they're not here tonight. That's why I'm only 5'4". They kept hitting me in the head. But I never did wear the clothes, that's a promise. Because of the atmosphere at home that I was brought up in, you know, I'd witnessed the disease of alcoholism from a very early age. And I couldn't wait to get the hell away from the family home. I remember in my early teens, you know, I'd made myself a promise that I would never drink. You know, I thought, well, if that's what booze does to people, it's not for me. And I meant it. I left high school at 18. Within 6 months, I got married and I moved down to London. My wife at the time, she was only 16. And she had three children within 2 years and 10 months. Then our married life was finished. I didn't know that then. You know, I didn't find out until later on. I worked in the gambling industry. I worked all over London initially, then all over the whole of Britain. And every one of the employers that I worked for, the bookmakers, you know, they thought the world of this wee guy. And I robbed every one of them blind. You know, I never get caught once. Not once. I didn't start drinking until I was about 21, 22. And whenever I started drinking, it was whiskey and Coca-Cola. And I loved the effect that it had on me. Like it says in this book, you know, that men and women drink essentially because they like the effect. You know, all of a sudden I was 7 foot tall. I've heard a lot of guys in the room since I've been around saying that when they were drinking, they thought they were God's gift to women. I never thought that. I knew it. My drinking career, as I said at that time, it didn't take too long. And I'm trying to cover as much ground tonight as possible because of the time. I remember 1970, we were back up in Scotland. The marriage was more or less on the rocks, you know, it got to the stage. Not just because of the drinking, but mainly that at night time I didn't even want to go home. I didn't want to go home. Because I knew as soon as I went home, the big picture was going to start. You know, the third degree. Where were you? Who did you see? What did you do? What did you, you know, I did that for years. But my wife and nearly all her family, and my employers and some of my friends, they all thought this wee guy had a problem with his drinking. And at that time, I had two problems with my drinking. I couldn't get enough of it. And I couldn't get peace to enjoy it. If they would just have left me alone, I'd be okay. But what they did was, they arranged for me to go and speak to a Catholic priest. I was brought up Catholic. And apparently this man was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I remember that day going to see him when it was about 25, 30 miles away from where I lived. And his name was Father Isaac McLaren. And I can mention it now because he died several years ago. I went to see this guy and we sat in two armchairs across from each other. And he started telling me a lot about his drinking. And out of the blue he said to me, "Willie, do you think you may be alcoholic?" I felt insulted. I really did. You know, did nobody tell this guy who I was? You know, don't want you to think I was big-headed. You know, and I remember saying to him, you know, "But I can't be an alcoholic. I don't drink cheap wine and beer like the down and outs. It's nothing but the best for me." You know, and that's when he explained to me that alcohol is not a drink. It's a drug called ethanol or ethyl alcohol. And he said, it's the same drug that's in the cheapest wine and beer as what's in the most expensive whiskey. And again, the defiance in me, I said to him, "But I can't be an alcoholic. I've got too much money." He said, "Well, just keep drinking, son. It won't last you long." And again, I come back at him and I said, "You know, but I can't be an alcoholic. I'm far too intelligent." It's the first time I'd heard a priest swearing. I've heard a few sins. And he said to me, "Yes, well, you're so effing intelligent. You can't count to one. If you don't take the first drink, you won't get drunk." I couldn't get away from him quick enough that night. And you know where I went. You know what? It was the nearest bar. That's where I went. The year after that, it was in June of 1971. I was working in a gambling place in Glasgow. Finished work at 6 in the evening. We all went across the road and into the lounge bar downstairs, where all the dolly birds were, you know, with the mini skirts, and that was my home. I remember leaving there that night about 11 o'clock, and we were all going to a party away over on the other end of Glasgow. I remember being at the person's house. I remember coming out of there, must have been maybe 2 or 3 in the morning. I remember sitting on the sidewalk with the rain pouring down. I remember some of my friends gathered around, and they were all pleading with me, you know, "Willie, don't drink, don't drive that car. You know, I can hardly stand." And they even tried to take my car keys off me. You know, they had no chance. I must have got in the car and started driving. What happened next, I've still got no recollection of. My next recollection was being given the last rites by another Catholic priest. my next recollection after that was there was a big black doctor standing over me with a clipboard asking me a load of stupid questions like, do you know what your name is? Do you know what happened to you? And this is a matter of medical record. I had over 250 stitches from the neck up. My ribs were broken. My pelvis was broken. My right thigh was broken in four places. My right shin was broken in three. And I broke every bone in my right ankle. I've now got one high heel. But if I didn't tell you that, you wouldn't know. My left leg was broken. My right wrist was nearly severed. They had to tie the tendons together under the skin. And they told me at that time that I would never walk again without a steel caliper. And I would never straighten my right arm and use my right hand. It was 40 years ago. And even today, I've still got a sensation of pins and needles in the palm of my hand. That didn't stop me drinking. For weeks after it, I was still spitting out pieces of glass from the inside of my mouth. They wouldn't allow my children in to see me because it was probably a horror show. Eventually, and I'm trying to get through as much as I can, I was in the hospital for about 4.5 months, and I remember one day my ex-wife came in to see me and she was all dressed in black. And at that time in their area there was a lot of people praying for me. And I'm sure that most of them were praying that I wouldn't make it. And I remember my wife coming in and telling me that one of my girlfriends was pregnant. And I would have done anything to try and keep my marriage together. Anything. If they'd asked me to do the Apache war dance in the middle of George's Square in Glasgow, I would have done it. But she said, you know, there's a friend that stayed near us and he's a member of AA. Do you mind if he comes and talks to me? So this guy came in to see me. His name is Pat Rooney. And Pat started telling me all about his drinking, and I ended up feeling sorry for the poor guy. You know? I'm lying there like, anyway, I was in the hospital for 4.5 months. And for the 4.5 months, I lay there, you know, with two chest expanders, one tied up on the top of the bed and one at the bottom, day and night, just going like that. And I straightened my arm. You know, even at that time, you know, when they told me I'd never walk again, my attitude all my life was, I'll show them. I'll show them. You know, you tell me I can't do something, just stand by. You know, the kind of guy I was. Eventually I got home from there and it took the best part of another year to learn to walk again. And that wasn't very easy. But again, eventually I got back to work. And I started drinking again. And by this time I'd never been to a meeting of AA. The atmosphere at home, you know, you could have cut it with a knife. But I remember one time, you know, my ex-wife told me that there was two other men were going to come to my house and pick me up and take me to a meeting about 30 miles away. And that was in the Red Cross rooms in Hamilton. And this was the very first meeting that I was ever at. And I remember, I can't remember much about what was said. You know, the speaker spoke for about an hour, then they start going around the room. And as they were going around the room, you know, it seemed to me that everybody in that meeting, they all knew about me. And to show you just how clever I was, I'm sitting there and I'm racking my brain trying to think, how did they know about me? And to show you just how clever I really was, then it dawned on me. When the guys have picked me up at home to take me to the meeting, she's been on the phone to all them. They've all got together and they've said, now when it's your turn, you say this, and it's your turn, you say this. That's how sick I was. I remember at that time they suggested that I go to 90 meetings in 90 days. And to the best of my recollection, I did that. I went to 90 meetings in 90 days. I remember that night, I was taking my wife and kids down to visit our parents. And I stopped the car outside the liquor store and I said to her, well, I mean, that's it. I mean, I proved it now. I'm cured. I'm cured. I'll just go in and get a quarter bottle of whiskey. And she didn't go ballistic like she normally did do on previous occasions. She just said, well, Willie, if that's what you want to do, you carry on. And I didn't know then that quarter bottle of whiskey was the start of me going in and out the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous for the next 12 years. I probably qualify for the Guinness Book of Records for the number of times I went in and out of AA. Demented. Absolutely demented. You see, when I went to AA at first, I still had my wife, my kids, and home, my jobs. And over that 12-year period, the only thing I did right was I kept coming back. Because I knew there had to be an answer, even for a lunatic like me, but I didn't know what it was. And they told me about some of the things that would happen to me if I kept on drinking. During that 12-year period, I lost my wife, my kids, my home, my jobs. I lost two businesses. I lost the love and the respect of my family and my friends. I became unemployed, unemployable. It was a nightmare. And yet some of the guys in the meetings used to say, well, Willie, just keep coming. Some of these nights you're going to hear your own story. And I hope and trust in my God today that I would hate to think there was some other poor so-and-so had to go through what I came through. During that time, I ended up doing quite a number of one-night stands in police stations. I ended up in a socking prison at Edinburgh. I got banned for drunk driving twice. I tried to commit suicide on 4 or 5 occasions, and they weren't half-hearted attempts. You know, I got to the stage in my life, you know, that I'd nothing left to go on for. I didn't want to go on. And I don't say this to try and impress anyone or to try and frighten anyone. This is just the way it was for me. You know, I'd become as open-minded to conviction as only the devil can be. I remember after my last drink, lasted 17 days, I appeared in the local sheriff court on the 6th of March, and this was on the 23rd of March. And I won't tell you how long I'm sober, but I will before I finish. And I remember during that night lying on the edge of my bed and was bringing up pints of blood. And again, I thank my God, because that morning there was a couple of guys came to my house. One of them, his name is Andy Davidson, and Andy's still a good friend of mine. But you see, when Andy came that day, he brought this thing with him, and I was speaking to someone outside before the meeting started, and I was telling him that I had this book at home for 7 years, never looked at a damn thing, because a lot of the meetings that I went to, you know, and trust me when I say this, this is not a criticism of the meetings as they were at that time. These are observations based on my own personal experience. At the meetings that I went to, there was no talk of God, a higher power. You know, anybody talking about that, you were asked to leave the room. We're not here for that nonsense. We're only here for booze. And all you were listening to was war stories. You know, but anyway, Andy came to my house that morning and he brought this book with me. And he introduced me to the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And he told me that this is a manual of instruction. This is the owner's manual for each and every one of us. And he showed it to me right on the very front cover, down at the bottom where it says, this is the basic textbook of Alcoholics Anonymous. And a textbook is a book to be studied and referred back to. And then he opened it up at the very first page. And under where it says, Alcoholics Anonymous, it says the story of how many thousands of men and women have recovered from alcoholism. Recovered. Past tense. And that's the tremendous hope that Andy gave me that day, is that yes, we can recover from this illness. But he was quick to point out that it doesn't mean cured. It just simply means to get well. And it tells me that in the book, that we are not cured of alcoholism. All we have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. Then he turned to chapter 5 and he told me that not everybody in AA is going to make it. And I'd been at thousands of meetings and I'd heard chapter 5 read out umpteen times, and I don't remember them ever saying that. But you see, he turned to chapter 5 and right at the beginning it says, those who do not recover. So there are those who will and there are those who won't. And in chapter 5 he goes on to tell me who they are. And there's only two kinds of people. It's the cannots and the will nots. They will not completely give themselves to this simple program. And right after the three ABCs in chapter 5, A, that we are alcoholic and we couldn't manage our own life, B, that probably no human power could, and C, that God couldn't even if he were sought. The next line in the book, the very next line says, being convinced, we are now at step 3. That's in chapter 5. And Andy looked at me and he said, so if that's in chapter 5, we're now at step 3 in chapter 5, where's steps 1 and step 2? I said, I don't know. He said, well, they're in the first 4 chapters of the book in the doctor's opinion. I didn't know that. Chapter 5 only tells me how to take step 3 and step 4. I didn't know that. In chapter 6, it's called into action. Tells me how to take step 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11. And I didn't know that. And I'd been around here for 12 years. Then there's another one. Chapter 7 is working with others. And that's a full chapter on the 12th step. You see, Andy suggested to me that day that I start and study this book no more than 2 pages a day and to believe everything that it says in it. At that time, I was living on my own. I was unemployed, unemployable. I was living in welfare. I'm the guy they wrote this book about. You know, I had so many problems that I despaired of ever solving them. That was me. I had them out in the depths up there. You would not believe. God almighty. And this really was the last chance saloon for this wee guy. And for me, and I knew then, for me it had to be total commitment. Just forget it. And I started studying the book as Andy suggested. And I learned discipline that I wouldn't go beyond the 2 pages. I would do the same 2 pages maybe 10, 20, 50 times a day. And early on in my sobriety, in the first week or so, there was one of the local members that gave me, he let me borrow some Joe and Charlie cassettes. Joe and Charlie, the big book guys. And I'm sitting at home on my own, listening to these guys on the tape. And I've got my book in front of me, and I'm underlining it the way they're telling me. And the parts that I'd already read and studied, they made it sound so simple. It's like somebody switched the light on in my head. And I'm thinking to myself, how did I not think of that? How did I? Incredible. Absolutely incredible. You see, I found out too that the first step in this program doesn't ask me to admit that I'm an alcoholic. The first step in this program asks me to admit that I'm powerless over alcohol. And I found out just what makes this wee guy powerless over alcohol by reading the doctor's opinion. Because in there it says, you know, that men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. And though after a while they admit that it is injurious, they cannot differentiate the truth from the false. And that once they start drinking, they're going to go through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution never to drink again. You know, restless, irritable, and discontent. Those 3 words were the story of my life, even before I started drinking. You know, this book tells me that if I keep on drinking, it will either end up in insanity or death. And I was close to that after my last drink. You know, the book goes even further. And it says, you know, to be doomed to an alcoholic death or to live on a spiritual basis are not easy alternatives to face. But you know what? That's the only choice we've got in AA. That's it, pal. Take it or leave it. To be doomed to an alcoholic death or to live on a spiritual basis. And I'm glad they said a spiritual basis and not a religious basis, because I would never have made it. You know, that my life is unmanageable, I've already explained that to you over that 12-year period. I lost everything. That's a good definition of unmanageability. I found out later on why my life is unmanageable. And that's because I had an idiot trying to run my life, myself. And I thought I was so clever. You know, God Almighty. You know, the second step in this program was the single most difficult one for me. Because in there it says that we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore me to sanity. You see, I didn't believe in a power greater than myself. And even at some of the meetings that I'd been to over that 12-year period, excuse me, when people weren't allowed to talk about God, I went right along with that. Because you wouldn't believe the resentment I had against God, you know. I've often said it for 42 years of my life. God to me was a sadist, and he didn't know it. And he kept punishing me for all the things that I'd done wrong. I found out later on in this program the truth of that statement. And the truth is that Wooly was a masochist, and I didn't know it. He punished me more severely. And I know today that our God doesn't punish any one of us. I was never punished for my sins. I was punished by my sins. And I remember saying to Andy, you know, Andy, I was brought up in the Catholic Church, and I knew since I was a little boy that I was going to roast in the bad fire. And it got to the stage, oh well, you might as well, if you can't beat them, just join them, you know. And Andy kept talking to me about a loving God, and I couldn't get my head around that. And then he showed me in the second tradition that talks about there's one ultimate authority in AA, a loving God. And again, I thank God for this book. I thank God for this book. Because in there it says that all we had to do was to become willing to believe in a power greater than ourselves. And in my case, it goes on to say that what seemed at first to be a flimsy reed turned out to be the loving hand of God. I remember I was only 2 weeks sober. 2 weeks. The head case had bounced in and out for 12 years. And I'm 2 weeks sober. And I'm standing in the main street of the town that I lived in. And I'm standing talking to a friend. Not an AA, just a friend. And it was just a quiet feeling that I had. And I knew in my head, and I knew in my heart, that the obsession to drink was gone. I knew it. And I can't describe it in any better language than I just did. But you know, even up until I was 6 months sober, and I'd never been 6 months sober, even up until I was 6 months sober, I was scared to tell anybody about that, in case the horrible craving for a drink would come back again, and they would laugh at me again. You know, and up till tonight, that craving for a drink has never come back. It's never come back. Absolutely incredible. And it came to the third step in this program. You know, I read out the third step just from the book, the way it was written, on my knees in my bedroom. Then I came across the example it gives us in step four, with Mr. Brown and Mrs. Jones, and I couldn't make head nor tail of it. And if you believe in coincidences, here's a belter for you. That very first priest that I was sent to see in 1970, Father Isaac McLaren, had been moved, and he was in a parish less than a mile from where I lived. And I walked down the hill to see him because I was banned for drunk driving. I went down to see him to ask him for his advice on the fourth step. And Father Mac said to me, well, he said, if you were looking for advice in the fourth step, he said, I would assume that you've taken the third step. I said, yeah. He said, how did you do it? And I told him, on my knees. He said, okay. He said, do you mind if we do it again? So the two of us knelt down and we said the third step prayer. And when we stood up, and I'm standing as close as Auntie Jim just now, he looked at me and he said, well, he said, by now, he said, you should be trusting in God. He said, if you trust in God, he will not allow anything bad to happen to you. He said that fear is the absence of faith, and faith is the absence of fear. And in chapter 5 it says, we stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. He said, so he's going to protect you and he's going to care for you. He said, do you believe that? And at that time, no, I didn't believe it, but I wanted to. And then he said to me, well, all you have to do from today on is just learn to accept everything that happens to you today, the good and the bad. Don't argue, don't fight it, don't struggle. Just accept that as being God's will for your just for today. Then he said, and do the same thing tomorrow. And I remember looking at him and thinking, shit, that'll never work. But I'm going to try it just to prove him wrong. And you know, I've been doing that now for the last 4 days and 2 months and 26 years. And it's never wrong. It's incredible. And I dare you to try it. And come back and tell me what happens. I think there's a lot of people in AA, they may be a long time away from drink, but they have never really made up their minds who's going to be in charge of their life, them or God. I feel sorry for them. I'm the living proof that this program works. So when we came to step 4, he said, well, I said, well, and at that time, in the area, they'd started handing out the John Charlie 4-step inventory guides. And he'd never seen them before. And I took a copy with me to let him see them. And he said, well, okay. He said, but let's see what it says in the book. And he opened the book and he turned to the page that says that we might not overcome drinking until we tell someone else all your life story. And that's what it says in the book. And he said to me, he said, Willie, you have to find the real me. And I hadn't a clue what he was talking about. And he explained it. He said, there are four me's in the fourth step. And he said, it's not the nice, wee, quiet family man that you wanted everybody to think that you were. And I could identify with that one. He said, it's not the genius that you believed in your own mind that you were. And I could identify with that one. And he said, it's not the right bastard that you believed in your own heart that you were. And I could identify with that one. He said, you have to find the real me. And that's the one that comes through forgiveness. And hopefully, that's the one that's standing here tonight. He said to me, he said, I don't want you to tell me anything that you've done. He said, I want you to go home and get a writing pad and a pen and write down everything you can remember up until you were 15. And you know, in chapter 5, it says that some of these we bought. I remember saying to him, wait, wait a minute, pal. I didn't start drinking till I was 21, 22. He just laughed. He said, well, I go home and get a writing pad and write down everything you can remember up to you were 15. And he said, it's not a race. Take your time. It took me about a month to get down the first episode. And during that month, I'd be walking down the street or on a bus or watching television. And some of the thoughts and memories that came back to my life was incredible. Things I was convinced I'd forgotten all about. And I just jotted them down, then I could expand on them later on. I went down and I shared that with him after a month. And he said to me, he said, I want you to carry on doing this for the rest of your life in 5-year cycles. And he said, I've got no idea the things that you might tell me happened later on in life when you left high school, got married, went to London. He said, but you worked in the bedding shops all your life. I said, yeah. He said, okay. He said, I'll have a bet with you right now that it's just a repetition of everything you did up until you were 15. And again, I remember looking at him and thinking, are you in for a surprise, pal? The things I've done. But you know, he was dead right. Because up until the age of 15, I was a thief and a cheat and a liar and a con artist and a people pleaser and a manipulator. And my sex life up there was 15. I'm still not too proud of it. It took me quite a while to finish my 4-step. And I thank God that at the time that I started getting sober, that for the first 3.5 years, I was unemployed. Because that gave me all the time that I needed to undertake the biggest job I have ever done in my life, and that's working on myself. And the wages are fabulous. I chose not to share my 5th step with Father Mike. I shared my 5th step with Andy Davison, the guy that introduced me to the book. And Andy came to my house on a Sunday morning, and I was still a bit apprehensive because there was a lot of things I hadn't done, mainly to do with sex. And I vowed, you know, I'll never share them with another living soul. I'll take them to the grave with me. And 26 years ago, I nearly did that. But I thank God for Andy, because when Andy came to my house that day, before I got a chance to say anything, Andy opened up and he shared in great depth the exact nature of his wrongs. Then I knew I wasn't unique. I wasn't the pervert that I thought I was, you know. And that's what gave me the courage and the confidence to go on and admit the exact nature of my wrongs. That session lasted about 6 hours. And physically it was draining. It was a long session. But I remember how I felt at the end of it. Mentally or emotionally or spiritually or call it what you want. I felt as high as a kite. I felt clean for the first time in my life. Clean on the inside as well as on the outside. And it's a feeling that I still enjoy. John Chamberlain describes it as being like an inside shower. And that's what it felt like. Step 6 and 7 in this book, you know, after we finish the fifth step, it says in here, it says we go home and we find a place where we can be quiet for an hour, 1 hour, then taking the book down from the shelf. And step 6 is just a prayer, and it says that this thought brings us to step 6, which says, my creator, I am now willing you should have all of me, the good and the bad. And at the end of it, it says we have now completed step 7. Step 6 and 7, it's only 8 lines. This program is no big deal. Trust me, it's not. Step 8, when they asked me to make a list of the people that I'd harmed. Again, I remember saying to Andy Davison, Andy, I can't do that. But by this time, I'd made a very thorough fourth and fifth step. And the number of people I'd harmed, either physically, mentally, financially, emotionally, sexually, I was totally ashamed, and I knew that I didn't want to hurt anybody anymore. But I remember saying to Andy, God, I wish they would have left out the last word, but it says make amends to them all. Because there's one guy in that list, and I told this guy right to his face, if ever I see you in this area again, I'll put this car right over the effing top of you. And I meant it, and he knew I meant it. I told you in 1971 about the car accident I had, being given the last rites by the Catholic priest. Over the next few years, we became the best of friends. On his day off, he would come out and visit us. And we became the best of drinking pals. And he'd bring out his briefcase and take out a bottle of whiskey, and I'd bring out a bottle of whiskey, and we'd sit there half the night. And we went everywhere together, we did everything together, and that went on for several years. And that man married my wife. What a betrayal that was. You have no idea the amount of anger, resentment. I didn't even know the word resentment until I came to AA. I just hated him. And as I said, I told him right to his face, if I see you again. And I'm not proud when I tell you that my parents, especially my mother, spent the last few years of her life in abject fear that I would end up serving a life sentence for murder, because my family knew the violence that I was capable of. And Andy said to me that day, Molly, you're going to have to pray for them. I remember looking at Andy and saying, pray for them, pray for them. I'd bury them in my front garden. And Andy said, well, it's either that or you'll drink again. And I didn't ever want to go back to the hell that I'd come out of. And I started praying for that guy. I didn't mean it at first, but gradually over the years it got to the stage that I would ask my God to give him some of the benefits he'd given me. He died several years ago, and as far as I know, he died sober as a member of AA. To the best of my recollection, I have made direct amends. You know, the wording in these steps is beautiful. It's very precise. You know, direct means face to face. And in the ninth step, it says, you know, wherever possible. It doesn't say whenever possible. It's not about running around knocking doors and saying I'm sorry. I've done that all my life, never meant it once. You know, and I had to try and make amends for some of the people I'd harmed. A lot of the people accepted it with good grace, and I thank them for that. A lot of others, they didn't even want to know. They said, you just get the F out of my road. And, you know, don't come back. You know. Anyway, I try and live every day in my life today by step 10, 11, and 12, because that's what it tells me in this book. And step 10 tells me, if there's anything bothering me today, it can only be one of four things: selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. And it tells me what to do about them. Step 11 talks about prayer and meditation. And prayer for me is just talking to my God. And I believe that my God is everywhere, so I can speak to him anywhere. And I speak to my God just the way I speak to you. You know, I don't need to run to buildings to talk to him. And I'm not criticizing anyone who does, that's fine. But not for me. Meditation is just listening to God. I had one of your convention speakers years ago, a guy called Ray O'Keefe, and you hear him saying there's another very fine form of meditation, and it's the kind that each of you are involved in right now. You're listening, and whenever I started getting sober in Scotland, they told me, you know, I had to learn to listen and listen to learn. I built up a good collection of American speaker cassettes, and I would sit and listen to them day and night. Because a lot of the things I was hearing on those tapes, you would never hear them in meetings at home. Never. You know, and it was always an ambition of mine to come over here just to go to meetings. Because I knew instinctively it's a different fellowship. It's a different fellowship. And I came over here for the first time in 1991, 20 years ago. And the first real American member that I met, I was with him this afternoon. His name's Jack. And we're still the best of friends. I was hoping he was going to be here tonight, but Jack's heard me before. Some of the best AA meetings that I've been at in Orlando over the 20-year period have been in Jack's apartment, just the two of us. Incredible stuff. He's a very special man in my life. As I say, I built up a big collection of cassettes and now graduated onto CDs, DVDs. You know, I'm a firm believer of what it tells me in this book, to give freely of what you find. Give freely of what you find. In step 12, and I'm watching the clock because I know this is birthday night, and you know, it's not my birthday, I don't care. I decided tonight before the meeting I would give you the short version, and the short version lasts for 3 hours. The biggest problem I have been asked to speak at any meeting is to try to get me to shut up. But it's not because I feel that I'm a smart ass, because I'm not. It's just because I feel so passionate about this book, about this program, about what's on offer for each and every one of us. And I nearly missed it. The 12th step, again, the wording is very specific, because it tells me in there, it says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. The result of these steps is a spiritual awakening. And I've had many, many spiritual awakenings in AA. But then it says that we try to carry this message. Not the message, this message. And I didn't know what this message was. And again, Andy, thank God for him. And the inside cover, this is a third edition, the inside cover about halfway down, it says this is a basic text. The pages 1 to 164 remains unchanged. Then it says, this is the AA message. That's the message I'm asked to carry. I believe that I've become everything in AA that I ever want to be. I don't want to be chairman of this or delegate to that. No thanks. I'm a message boy. What a fabulous message we're asked to carry. And if I don't know what it says in this book, and I haven't applied it into my life, how in the name of God can I try and carry this message? I'd like to just backtrack for a few minutes. I'll take you back to March of 1994. I'd been over here for 3 months staying with my friend Jack in Orlando. I'd gone back home to Scotland. I went to the usual Monday night meeting in Glasgow that I'd been going to for years, and I knew everybody in the room. And this particular night, there was a big guy sitting down on his own with his cup of tea, and I went down and introduced myself. And as soon as he opened his mouth and heard the American accent, and he said, "My name's John." And I said to him, "Are you here on vacation, John?" And he said, "No." I said, "I'm here as part of my job." Of course, the next question is, "What do you work at?" And he said, "I'm a Catholic priest." And that night after the meeting, he asked me for my phone number, and he asked me if I'd sponsor. That could only happen in AA. I spoke to him a couple of days ago. We're still the best of terms. He came down and stayed with me for a couple of weeks, 3 years ago, and I brought him to meetings in this room. But he made me promise him not to tell anyone that he was a white collar worker. But he's now 36 years sober. I'll take you to the summer, June of 1998. I hadn't seen my three kids for years because of my ex-wife. She's still very, very bitter against me. I'm still public enemy number one. That's her problem, it's not mine. But in the summer of 98, I got a letter from my youngest daughter, her name's Geraldine, telling me that she was a patient in a psychiatric hospital not far from where I lived and where I go and see her. I was in that hospital within an hour, and I didn't even recognize her. Geraldine had been a nurse, tiny little girl, very thin, and she'd injured her back lifting one of the patients, which is a common complaint with nurses. They put her on all sorts of medications, and she had all sorts of scans and God knows what. She was like a zombie. I spent the next 6 months, either every day or every evening, Geraldine would be in my house or I would go and see her in her house. And she could never open up and tell me what was wrong. She would just say, "Dad, I don't feel safe. And that I don't enjoy peace of mind or happiness." It's tragic. And I remember on Saturday the 2nd of January 1999, I was asked to speak at a meeting back home in Scotland. And I remember telling the people in the room that night about my daughter Geraldine. And I remember saying to them, I had to admit that I was powerless over Geraldine, that she made my life unmanageable, and that I'd come to believe that only a power greater than me could restore her to sanity. And I made a decision that night to turn her will and her life over to the care of my God. That was Saturday the 2nd of January 1999. The following Tuesday, I got a phone call from my son that I hadn't seen for years. They tell me that Geraldine was dead. She'd hanged herself. I assumed that she'd hanged herself the night before, the Monday night. My ex-wife had been to Geraldine's house. She couldn't get in because Geraldine wouldn't give her a key. The dog was barking, they called the local cops, they managed to get in, that's when they found her. It wasn't until the next day, the Wednesday, when they had the autopsy. That's when they discovered that Geraldine had hanged herself on the Saturday night, the night I spoke in the meeting. I thank God at that time for the number of friends that I had over here in Florida and in Washington DC where Father John was. Because I was on the phone every night of the week for hours, and I couldn't care less what the phone bill was. And I was breaking my heart crying. The friends here in Orlando and Melbourne, Naples, you name it. And I needed all that help. You see, that particular week leading up to the funeral, there was loads of AA friends in my home. But they all went home about 11 or 12 o'clock at night because they had their own families and kids. But you see, when it's midnight in Scotland, it's only 7 o'clock in the evening over here. And that's when I needed the help. And I'll be forever grateful for that help. I'm going to wind this up. You know, I'm just going to talk a little bit more about this book. This book really has saved my life. And I would like to think that in time, this book will come to mean as much to every one of you as it does to me. You know, and control the imagination, I often wonder, what would our co-founders say if they were here tonight? And somehow I can hear Dr. Silkworth saying, we earnestly urge every alcoholic to read this book through, and though perhaps you came to scoff, you may remain to pray. I can hear Bill Wilson saying, if you're an alcoholic who wants to get over it, you may already be asking, what do I have to do? Then he says it's the purpose of this book to answer these questions specifically. Dr. Bob, the quiet man in AA, I can hear him saying, if you think you're an atheist, an agnostic, or a skeptic, or suffer from any other form of intellectual pride which prevents you from accepting what's in this book, I feel sorry for you. And I would like to add, so do I. I think that whenever I die, my God isn't going to ask me, how long have you been sober? How many meetings did you go to? Nonsense. But I think what he is going to ask me is, what did you do with the gift of sobriety that I gave you? And I want to be able to say to him, I gave it away for free and for fun. I'll finish up with the words of my sponsor, Father Mac. And I often heard him saying that Alcoholics Anonymous didn't come into existence to make life easy, but it did come into existence to make men and women great. And I thank each and every one of you for listening to me tonight, because tonight again, I feel great. Thank you.